We're at the very bottom of Mem Beis, by the two dots, where it says, Minahani Mili. Our Mishnah presented a list of items that are excluded from the biblical oath. And that list was slaves, documents, land, as well as property that had been consecrated to the Beis HaMikdash. If there was a financial dispute about one of these types of assets, and let's say the defendant admitted to part of the claim, he would not take the biblical oath as derived from a drasha, from the passage in the Torah that discusses this oath obligation. The Mishnah said that this same list is excluded from other laws, such as the double payment by a thief, the 4-5-fold payment. And then the Mishnah said that these assets would not be subject to the regular halachos of shomrim, of custodians. The Torah sets down different laws in terms of if perhaps the shomer will have to swear, if he wants to claim that he's exempt because he wasn't, you know, negligent. And regarding the paid watchman, he would not have to pay if the object got lost or stolen, even though normally he does have to pay, but not by these things. So let's first discuss the Mishnah's ruling that shomer chinam eino nishba. If there was an unpaid watchman of any of these items, and the owner came for his item, and the shomer said, I'm sorry, but it's gone, and he claimed that it was an accident, it was not as a result of his negligence. Normally the Torah says he would have to take an oath that he wasn't negligent, but not by these items listed in the Mishnah. The Gemara asks, Minahani Mili? From where do we know this? And the Gemara answers, the Tana Rabbanan, as was taught by the Rabbanan in a Braisa continuing to Mem Gimel Amid Aleph, the passage that relates the laws of an unpaid watchman begins with Ki Yitein Ish El Reyehu. The man gives him property to his fellow to watch. So this first statement is what we call a klal. It's a very general statement. It would imply that the laws that follow apply to any kind of property entrusted to this custodian. But then the pasuk continues with some specific examples. It says Kesef O Kalim. He gave him money or utensils. So this is called prat. This is a specific statement. There seems to be defining things here. But then it later says lishmar. It simply says the word to watch, implying whatever was being watched. So chazer v'klal. And now it returns to generalize the halacha. So we have here a klal uprat uklal, a structure that consists of a general, then specific, then general statement. In which case, the rule is, yata dana lekeina prat. We take the specific examples, although we don't say that the halacha is limited to only, you know, literally those because of the general statements. However, the specific statement serves to define the halacha only to those things that are significantly similar to the examples mentioned. And so here that means ma'aprad mefurash davra metaltel v'gufa mammon. Just as the specific examples in the pasuk here, money, utensils, possess the qualities that they are movable and they have intrinsic worth, af kol davra metaltel v'gufa mammon. These therefore become the necessary qualities for the item in question to be included in the law of Shomer Chinam, that includes the obligation for him to swear if he claims that the property was lost at no fault of his. Therefore, based on this definition, Yatsu Karkos She'e Metaltlin, we first of all exclude land from this passage, being that land is not movable. Furthermore, Yatsu Avadim She'hokshu LeKarkos. Once land is excluded, slaves would also be excluded since they are scripturally compared to land. Slaves are legally considered land. In addition, Yatsu Shtoros. Documents would be excluded if this Shomer Chinam is entrusted with some legal document, even if it represented value. For She'afal Pishim Metatlin, even though it's movable, it has that quality. But Ein Gufon Mama. A document has no intrinsic value, and so they're excluded. And finally, the Braisa says, a hegdish, property that was consecrated to the Beis HaMikdash, is also excluded from this passage because re'eyu ksiv. The pasuk mentions that the shomer here, that the property was entrusted to, was his fellow. We can't describe giving something to the Beis HaMikdash, which is technically the property of God, is, you know, giving something to one's fellow. Therefore, Hegdish is also excluded from the law of Shomer Chinam. The Mishnah then mentioned that Nosei Sachar in a Mishalim. And regarding these items in the Mishnah, this list, the paid watchman would not be liable to pay in case of theft or if it got lost. even though normally he does have to pay there, he has a higher expectation since he's being paid. However, that halacha does not apply by the list of items in our Mishnah. So again, we need to establish minhalan. From where do we know this? What's the source? So the Gemara answers, again with the Braisa, that presents a pretty similar drasha to the above. The Tan Rabbanan, the Rabbanan Tan Nebraisa, that by the passage of the Shomer Sachar, the paid watchman, we find the following language. Again, it starts with Ki Yitein Ish El Re'ehu. If a man should entrust his fellow with his property to watch this time for pay. So again, the first statement is Klal. He's stating very generally, whatever he entrusted him with, the following law applies. But then it continues with Chamar, Ashar, Seh. Specifically, he gave him a donkey, an ox, or a sheep. So this is a Prat. This now is a specific statement. But then it's followed by V'chol behema lishmar, or any animal to watch, chazer v'klal. It follows up with a general statement. And so taken all together, it forms klal uprat uklal. General, then a specific, then a general statement. Chule and etc. Drasha, you know, then proceeds exactly as we stated above regarding a shomer chinam. All the way on the hegdesh reyu ksev, including the last point that we also exclude, consecrated property from the law of a shomer sachar, based on this term reyu, it says, you know, he entrusted it to his fellow, so that would not apply if you're talking about where it's under the jurisdiction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Mishnah then presented a dispute between Rabbi Meir and the Rabbanan about a case of grapevines that were laden with grapes, and the plaintiff claimed that the defendant owed him 10 of these. The defendant said, no, I only owe you 5. Rabbi Meir and the Mishnah said that the defendant would have to swear, just like any other case where he admits to part of a monetary claim. So he would have to swear that he doesn't owe the other 5 as well. Whereas the Chachamim apply the rule, the exemption the Mishnah taught, that there's no oath by land. And the Chachamim consider these grapevines to be land. They say, listen, it's attached to the ground, so it's legally considered a part of the ground, and therefore there's no oath here. So the Gemara infers and notes the problem that Mechlal, the Rabbi Meir, Savar. This implies that Rabbi Meir holds Kol Mechuber Lekarka Eino Kekarka, that just because something is attached to the ground doesn't mean it's considered like the ground itself. And hence Rabbi Meir says he does have to swear. The Gemara asks, if that's the dispute here, we have this, you know, fundamental dispute, whether something attached, you know, growing from the ground is considered, you know, legally part of the ground. The question is, ad miflagi b'teunos, rather than present the dispute as about this case of the grapevines, which are laden with grapes, there's plenty of grapes growing on them, liflagi b'srukos, why do we need that detail? Just talk about vines that have nothing growing on them. The fact that they're laden with grapes seems irrelevant. The Gemara answers, Amar Rabbi Yosi bar Rabbi Chanina, he explained that actually the grapes growing on the vines is the central part of the dispute. For Hacha be'anavim omendos lihibatzer kemiflagi. The Chachamim and Rabbi Meir are specifically discussing grapes that are growing on the vines that are ready to be harvested. They don't need the ground anymore. And their dispute is the following. The Rabbi Meir Savar Kivitsuros Damya. The Meir holds, since they're ready to be cut, legally it's as if they've already been harvested. And therefore, legally, they're considered detached from the ground. And that's what Rabbi Meir says, that the biblical oath applies. Whereas Rabbanan Savi Lokivitsuros Damya. Rabbanan hold that although they might be ready to be harvested, since physically they're still attached to the ground, they're still legally considered attached to the ground. And since they're considered like land, therefore the biblical oath does not apply. So the Gemara is concluding that if you're talking about, you know, regular growth from the ground that still, you know, needs the ground to grow, then everybody would agree that it's considered part of the ground. And as such, the Shvua of Modav Miktas would not apply. The Mishnah then ruled that Ein Yishbayin Ela Al Davar Shebemida VeShebemishkal. The biblical oath would not apply unless the amount of the claimed property in question was, you know, quantified in some meaningful way. As opposed to if the amount the plaintiff was claiming was described in a, you know, somewhat vague manner in terms of the amount, then the biblical oath would simply not apply. And the Mishnah provided an example. The Mishnah said, if the plaintiff said, you have a house full of my produce. And the defendant admitted only to an amount less than that, there would be no biblical oath in that case, since the amount being claimed wasn't quantified in a meaningful way. The Gemara qualifies the Mishnah's ruling, Amar Abaye, Lo shanu ella the Amar le Abaye stam. The Mishnah's ruling here would only apply if the plaintiff had merely said, you have a house full of my produce. He did not specify any particular house. Aval Amar le Abaye zeh male. If he did specify, he said, you have produce that fills up this house, and that would be an adequate description of the amount for Yediyah Tanase. For, you know, if he is referring to a specific house, then the amount he's claiming could be ascertained. And so he has adequately quantified the amount he's claiming, and therefore the biblical oath would apply, assuming that the defendant only admitted to part of that. We're able to measure, you know, the total claim and the amount of that claim that the defendant admits to. The Gemara questions this distinction. Amar le Rava. Rava asked Abaye, Ihachi, if so, if that's true, seems to be a problem, for the Mishnah goes on to offer an example of a case where the biblical oath would apply. Mishnah described the case where the plaintiff got more specific. He said, you have an amount of my produce that, you know, fills up this house up until the ceiling beam, and the defendant says back, no, I only have your produce that filled up until the window. The Mishnah stated in this case, Chayev, the defendant, would be obligated to swear because the amounts were described, you know, more specifically. The question is, Liflog v'lisni b'dida. If what Abaye said is true, then the Mishnah ought to have provided a contrast case here that it wasn't this far away from the previous case. Namely, the Mishnah should have said, you know, we just said, if the plaintiff is very vague, he says, you have my produce that fills up a house, well, then that's not clear enough, and there would be no biblical oath. The Mishnah should have continued with, b'med v'rmamurim, when would this be the halacha, b'bayis male? It's only where he didn't specify any particular house, he just said, a house full of produce. Aval bayis zeh male chayiv. However, if he referred to a specific house, and he said, you have produce of mine that fills up this entire house, and the defendant admitted to part of that, then the defendant would have to swear. That's what the Mishnah should have said, according to Abaye. Based on this problem, Rava explains differently. Elam Rava, rather Rava said, Liolam eno chayev et shiyetanano bedavar shebemida shebemishko v'shebeminyan v'yodeh lo bedavar shebemida v'shebemishko v'shebeminyan. The halacha is narrower than what Abaye had claimed. Really, there would be no oath unless the plaintiff and defendant to refer clearly to specific amounts that are measurable. Meaning that even if the plaintiff had said, you know, he'd mentioned this specific house, you know, this specific house that's full, it's not clear enough. He's not being specific enough. And so in that case, the biblical oath would not apply. But if, you know, he's referring to a specific house and he gets specific, he says up until this point, and the defendant says, no, only up until this point, well then, you know, that's already measurable. We can measure what each one claims, and therefore, you know, that would be a case where the biblical oath applies. And the Gemara now says, Tanya Kavuse the Rava. The following Brisa supports Rava's opinion. Says the Brisa, if the plaintiff claimed kar tua libiyadcha, you have a kor's amount of produce of mine, v'hala omer ein lecha biyadi, if the defendant denies everything, he says, I have nothing of yours, potter. In this case, of course, the defendant need not swear. He's enough to take the biblical oath because he hasn't admitted to anything. The Raisa continues, if the plaintiff claimed menorah gedola yeshli biyadcha, you have a large menorah, a candelabra of mine, and the defendant says, ein lecha biyadi ala menorah ketana. He says, no, I have a small menorah of yours, not the large one that you describe. Says the Braisa, the halacha here is potter. The defendant is exempt. For here, the defendant's admission was about something that's not only quantitatively different, it's qualitatively different. It's a totally different thing. It's a different type. And as the Mishnah taught us, when the admission is about something that's considered a different type than that which was claimed from him, then the oath does not apply. Similarly, if the plaintiff had claimed a Zorah Gedola Yeshli Biyadicha, hey, you have my large belt, he described this large belt, and the defendant says, Ein Lecha Biyadi Al Zorah Ketana, he says, I don't have a large belt, but I have a small belt of yours, Potter. Again, the defendant is exempt from the biblical oath for the same reason that we explained by the large and small menorah case. The Raisa continues, Avalomer lo kar tfua yesh li biyadcha, v'alomer ein lecha biyadia lelesach. But if, for example, the plaintiff had claimed a whole kar's amount of produce, and the defendant responds that, no, you don't have a whole kar, you only have a lesach amount of produce. In this case, chayiv, the defendant will have to take the biblical oath. This is a classic situation of a defendant admitting to part of the claim of the plaintiff. And so he has to swear about the part that he is denying. And the Braisa states further, if the plaintiff had claimed menorah bas eser litrin yeshli biyadecha, he said, you have a candelabra that weighs 10 litra, that belongs to me. The defendant says back in, lecha biyadecha la bas chamish litrin. He says, I do have a candelabra of yours, but it weighs only 5 litrin, chayiv. Here, the defendant has to swear. This is a case where he's modu b'miktsas, he admits to part of the claim of the plaintiff. The Gemara will elaborate on this case. The Braisa then says, klal shel davar. You can sum this up with the following general rule. Le'olam eino chayiv. Defendant will never have to take the biblical oath for being modu b'miktsas ad sheyitenenu b'davar shebemidah v'shebemishkol v'shebeminyan, unless and until the plaintiff had claimed a quantified amount v'yodilo b'davar shebemidah v'shebemishkol v'shebeminyan, and the defendant responded by admitting to a quantified amount just less than that which the plaintiff was claiming. That's the only case where the biblical oath will apply. The Gemara now shows how the Braisa supports Rava's ruling above. For the Gemara says, "Klolo shel davar la suye mai." Whenever a Mishnah or Braisa says, it states like a general rule, the presumption is it's coming to include a specific case. So which specific case is this Braisa coming to include with its concluding general statement? Lav la suye bayis ze male. Apparently, the Braisa is coming to include Rava's case. That is, where the plaintiff described the amount that he's claiming in terms of a house. And the Braisa is teaching us that saying, this house is not good enough. For he has not sufficiently quantified the amount, and therefore, he would not have to swear. So it's a proof to Rava. The Gemara now seeks to understand the Braisa's rulings about these cases where the plaintiff had claimed a menorah from this person. The Gemara wonders, Umayshna menorah gidolo, menorah kitana. Why, on the one hand, did the Braisa say that if the plaintiff had claimed a large menorah and the defendant said, no, I only have your small menorah, that here the biblical oath would not apply because mashatana lo hodelo, mashodelo lo tano, since, you know, what this defendant admitted to was qualitatively different, it was a different thing. A small menorah is not the same thing as a large menorah. So very good, we understand that, but yachi, if so, then even in the later case in the Braisa of the Bas Eser, Bas Chamesh Nami, the plaintiff had claimed a menorah that weighs 10 litra, and the defendant said, no, I have a menorah that belongs to you, but it only weighs 5 litra. Seems to, you know, basically be the same case, and so we should say again, Mashatana lo hodelo, Mashatana lo lotana. Defendant admitted to a different thing than it was claimed from him. And yet, the Braisa says that in this case, he does have to swear. The question is, why? So the Gemara answers, Om Rabbi Shmuel Barav Yitzchak. He said, Hacha b'menorah shel chuliyos askina. The candelabra in the seifa of the Braisa is a candelabra that's made up of multiple parts. And what's really going on in this case is, the kemod le'mina. The defendant is claiming that he only has a certain number of parts of the menorah that weigh 5 litra. The plaintiff is saying, no, you have all the parts or more parts. Point is, you know, weighs more parts that weigh 10 litra. And this then is clearly a case where the defendant and plaintiff are talking about the same thing. Question just is, how much of it does he owe? And therefore, in this case, the Braisa said he has to swear. But the Gemara wonders, and once you're going to say that by the menorah case, if so, Azoranami nisni velukmi bidlayafi. The Braisa then ought to have taught an equivalent case by the belt case. That is, let it discuss where you have a belt that's made up of different parts, it's like stitched together. And the Braisa could have made this same point that if the defendant is admitting only to having, you know, less parts of the belt than the plaintiff had claimed from him, then he would have to swear. So evidently, Ella, the Laifi Lokitani, we see the Braisa is not interested in discussing such a case. Well, if so, Hachanami Bishachulios Lokitani. Presumably then, the Braisa is not coming to discuss in the menorah case either, a case where you have something made up of a bunch of different parts, and the defendant admits only to some of those parts being claimed. So therefore, the Gemara says this reading is not going to work, and Ella, rather the Gemara explains as follows, that whereas in the earlier part of the Braisa, when it referred to menorah gedola, menorah katana, there indeed it's two different things. The plaintiff is claiming this, you know, large size menorah, and the defendant is saying no, it was a smaller menorah, so in that case there's no oath. In this later case of a dispute about, you know, what kind of menorah is owed, plaintiff and defendant agree on the basic structure of the menorah, the, you know, general size of the menorah. They're only arguing about the thickness of the menorah, like how much actual weight is in that menorah. Plaintiff is saying its thickness was such that it was 10 litra. The defendant is saying no, this menorah only weighed 5 litra. But again, they agree on the basic size of the menorah. And so the Gemara explains, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Mamal, shiny menorah. This case of menorah is different, for even though they are describing menorahs of a different thickness, we don't say that their respective claims are describing a qualitatively different menorah because of the fact that a person could take a 10 litra thick menorah and scrape that down into a 5 litra menorah. Since you could take a 10 litra one and turn it into a 5 litra one, it shows us that these two menorahs are not, you know, substantially different. It's just a question of the amount of actual metal content. And therefore, the Braisa ruled in this case, he would have to swear, for they are describing the same thing. It's just that the defendant is saying that, you know, I owe less of that same thing. Next Mishnah begins, Hamalva es chavero al hamashkon. Let's say somebody lent someone else money on collateral. The borrower gave the lender something of value as collateral for the loan, ve'ovad hamashkon. And the lender lost the collateral. And the lender and borrower then have the following dispute. Amar lo selel visicha alav v'shekel ha'yeshava. The lender claims that the loan was for his sella, and that part they agree about. He claims this collateral that he lost is worth a shekel, which is half a sella. And therefore, the lender was claiming that you, Mr. Borrower, owe me another shekel after we deduct the amount of the mashkan that I lost. But vihala omer, the borrower says back, lo, ki ella sella visani alav is sella yeshava. The collateral I gave you was worth a full sella, the entire amount of the loan. Therefore, I owe you nothing. In this case, the halacha is pater. The borrower is completely exempt, doesn't have to pay. He doesn't even have to swear because this is a situation where he, you know, completely denied owing any money, in which case there is no biblical oath. The Mishnah then discusses this case. Let's say the dispute was, the lender said, selel visicha lo vishekel yeshava. Again, the lender says, okay, I lost your collateral. It was worth one shekel, so you still owe me a shekel because the loan was a sella to shkolim. Allah Omer, the borrower says, lo, ki ela sella visani alav ushlosha dinarim hayeshava. He says, my collateral was worth more than that. It was worth 3 dinars, which is 3/4 of a sella. And so I only owe you 1 dinar, not a full shekel. Says the Mishnah in this case, chayiv, the borrower will have to swear because this is a case where he's modav imiktas. He has admitted to part of the lender's claim, which was that you owe me a full shekel. The borrower says, I don't owe you a full shekel, I only owe you 1 dinar. And therefore, this is a situation where the biblical oath applies. The Mishnah continues now with this case. Let's say the dispute was as follows. The borrower claimed, selel visani alav ushtayim hayeshava, that actually this collateral that you lost was worth more than the loan. It was worth 2 salayim, and therefore you, Mr. Lender, owe me 1 sela. Ve'ala omer lo, ki ala selel visicha alav sela yeshava. The lender says, no, the collateral was worth the exact same amount as the loan. Therefore, I owe you nothing. Mishnah says, in this case, Potter, the lender, will not have to swear, because here he's completely denying the borrower's claim that he owes him money. The Mishnah continues, if, however, the dispute was, the borrower claimed, Sela v'yisani alav ushtayim yeshava, that again, the collateral was worth 2 slayim, and the loan was for 1 sela, so you owe me a sela, ve'ala omer lo ki ela sela v'yisicha alav chamisha dinarem yeshava. The lender says your collateral wasn't quite worth 2 salayim. Rather, it was worth 5 dinarim, and therefore I only owe you 1 dinar, not a whole sela. Says the Mishnah Chayiv, in this case, since the lender is admitting to part of the borrower's claim from him, he is obligated to swear. The Mishnah then says these words, Umi nishba, who swears, misha pikadon etzlo, the one who was in possession of this deposit, meaning of the collateral, i.e. the lender. Lender is the one that swears. Now the Gemara will discuss in which case is the Mishnah referring to with this statement. As we'll see, it doesn't make sense to explain that's going on the case that we just finished discussing, because in that case, you know, obviously the lender swears. So the Gemara will explain that the Mishnah is going back on the previous case, where really the borrower should be the one to take the oath, because he's the one who admitted to part of the claim against him. However, the Mishnah says, in practice, the lender swears. And why is that? For Shema Yishav Ezev, for perhaps, if we have the borrower swear, then maybe after V'yotzi Allah Sepikadam, the lender will later produce the deposit, the collateral, and will be able to just go ahead and assess it, you know, determine the true value, and it might very well refute the borrower's claim, which would mean then that he took a false oath, he would be disqualified from testifying. So to prevent this kind of situation, we have the lender swear to his claim about the value of the collateral, and then he collects accordingly. Turning to Amud Beis, the Gemara begins by explaining this last part of the Mishnah that we just discussed. The Gemara starts by asking that, you know, from the reading itself, it's not immediately clear in which case we're referring to. Which case is the Mishnah discussing now when it says that, you know, who swears, and it tells us that the lender swears. Ilei Masef, if you say, you know, the natural thing would be to understand it's going on the case we just discussed. But the Gemara says, if we're talking about that case, well, here, the lender is the one who is admitting to part of the claim brought against him by the borrower. And so the statement wouldn't make sense, because the Mishnah is saying here that the Rabbanan intervened, you know, changed the normal halacha and shifted the oath obligation to the lender. But if we're talking about the sefer, this last case, there's nothing to do with that. There's no special intervention. Rather, v'tepuk le'deshvua gabe malva. The basic law in this case is that the lender swears. Obviously, he swears because he is the one who admitted to part of the claiming brought against him in this case. Therefore, the Gemara answers, Amar Shmuel Aresha. Shmuel said, it's clear that the Mishnah is referring back to the previous case, where it's the borrower who admitted to part of the claim brought against him by the lender. And these other Amorayim echoed Shmuel. They said the same thing. We're going back to the Reisha, and the Gemara clarifies my Reisha. What is meant here by Reisha? If you say that it means the very first case of the Mishnah, well, then that would be problematic, because in that case, nobody swears. So the Gemara clarifies means Seifa de Reisha. Reisha here means like the earlier section of the Mishnah, but means the second case in that earlier section, namely the case where the lender claims selel v'sichalav v'shekel ha'yeshava, the collateral is only worth a shekel, so you still owe me a shekel for the loan. V'Allah omer lo ki l'selel v'sani alav v'shloshe dinar na'yeshava. The borrower counterclaims that the collateral was worth more than you're saying, and so I owe less of the loan. The Mishnah said, chayef, there is an oath obligation here. And so this is what the end of the Mishnah is saying about this case, that even though really the shvua gabe lovei, the oath obligation is upon the borrower. He's the one who admitted to a part of the lender's claim, so really he should swear. However, v'sheklua rabbanon mi lovei v'shedyuha amalve, the rabbanon took this oath obligation from the borrower and placed it instead on the lender, that he swears and then collects. Because of this concern that, you know, if you have the borrower swear, you might end up being exposed to be making a false oath. Maybe tomorrow the lender will produce the collateral. He says, oh, I didn't lose it after all. And that will, you know, disqualify the borrower. So to avoid that, just have the lender swear to his claim about how much it's worth, and then he'll collect. The Gemara presents a different reading of the Mishnah. That is, V'hashta the Yomar Ravashi. In light of his statement of Ravashi in Bab Mitzia about our Mishnah, the Kaimel and Ravashi said that the established halacha is, and in the Mishnah's second case, where the borrower is admitting to part of the lender's claim, he says, it's true that the collateral was worth less than the loan, but not, you know, as little as you claimed. The Mishnah says there's an oath obligation. Ravashi says that actually both parties have to swear. Ze nishba sheina bereshuso. The lender must too swear. He swears that he indeed is not in possession of the collateral. we're concerned that, you know, maybe he's claiming it's lost, but really he's just keeping it for himself. So he has to swear that it's really lost. Whereas the borrower swears to his claim about how much he's claiming the collateral was worth. In light of Rav Ashi's reading of this case of the Mishnah, we can now explain that Hachi Kamar. Here's what the Mishnah is saying at the end. Mi Nishba Tchila. The Mishnah is discussing who swears first, not who swears, but who swears first. The Mishnah says, Mishapi Kodin Etzlo. We make sure that the lender swears first that he really doesn't have this collateral anymore. Why is that important? Because otherwise, if the borrower swears first about the value of the collateral, Shem Yishav Ezeh, maybe after he swears about that, V'yotzi Allah Sepikadon, the lender will then whip out the collateral, say, haha, really, I do have the collateral, and will evaluate it, and it will refute the borrower's oath, and so it will be a false oath. The borrower will be disqualified as a witness. Therefore, we make sure to have the lender swear first. So this would be a whole different reading, which is not saying that we shift the oath obligation from the borrower to the lender. Rather, they both have to swear about different issues. And the Mishnah is just explaining that in order to avoid the situation where the borrower's oath would be refuted, we have the lender swear first that he really doesn't have it in his possession. And then the borrower swears about, you know, how much he's saying it was worth. The Gemara continues with the case of a collateral. Amar Shmuel. Shmuel said, Hai man de osve alfa zuzi lechavre umashke le kosa de magla. Say somebody lent his friend 1,000 zuz, and the borrower gave the lender a little sickle handle as a collateral. Says Shmuel, if they didn't specify otherwise, Ovid kosa de magla, Ovid alfa zuzi. If the lender later loses that little sickle handle, he loses his 1,000 zuz. So Shmuel appears to teach a whole new way of understanding Mashkon, that the understanding is that unless the lender can reproduce, can return that collateral, he loses the right to collect. You know, we don't say that we just deduct the value of that little handle and he collects the rest. Nope, he loses his right to collect entirely if he loses the collateral. However, Shmuel draws a distinction. He says, Avol tarti kosoi. Let's say the borrower had given the lender 2 handles as collateral, and the lender lost one of them. Lo, we would not say in that case that, okay, let's look at both handles. They each correspond to half of the loan. And so if he lost one of the handles, he should not be able to collect 500 of the loan. We don't say that in this case. Rather, we say that since at least, you know, part of the collateral is still being returned, he has a right to collect, and you just deduct the value of that handle that was lost from the amount he collects. However, V'rav Nachman Amar Afilu Tarti Kasase, even in this case where 2 handles were given as collateral, we say Avad Chada Avad Chamish Mea. We do say that it's proportionate. Each handle represents half of the loan. So if one handle was lost, the lender loses the right to collect an entire half of the loan. And if Ovid Yedach, if he loses the other handle too, Ovid Kule loses the ability to collect the entire loan. Avol Kosa V'nascha Lo. However, Rav Nachman says, in a different case, where let's say the borrower gave this little, you know, relatively low value handle plus an ingot, a bar of like valuable metal, if those 2 items were given as collateral, lo, we would no longer say that the collateral serves as a necessary prerequisite before he can collect. Rather, we would say that, you know, nascha already has some real value, and so presumably the lender accepted this nascha as a potential payment for the loan, and therefore if the nascha is lost, then we simply deduct that amount from the loan. That's the halacha in this case, Rav Nachman says. However, Narda Yomri, sages of Narda said, Afilu kasa v'nascha, even in this last case, even if it was something of, you know, low value plus a piece of metal that had significant value, still we continue to say that it's not, you know, considered potential payment for the loan. Rather, it's a prerequisite to be able to collect. And you have these like 2 items, so each represents half for the loan. So avid nascha, avid palga, avid kasa, avid kule. If he lost one of them, he loses the right to collect half for the loan. If he loses the other item, he loses the right to collect the other half of the loan. The Gemara now challenges Shmuel's teaching from our Mishnah. For it's not, our Mishnah said, describe this case where the lender says, to say, I lent you a sela, which is 2 shkalim, and the collateral that you gave me that I lost was only worth 1 shekel, and therefore you still owe me a shekel. That's the lender's claim here. V'Allah Omer Lo Ki Yelasel V'Yisani Alav U'Shlosh Dinar In Hayeshave. The borrower counters that it's not true. My collateral was worth more. It was worth 3 dinarin, and therefore I only owe you 1 dinar. The Mishnah ruled chayiv. The borrower, since he admitted to part of the claim, is obligated to swear. The Gemara points out, according to Shmuel, though, this whole case doesn't seem to make sense. For according to Shmuel, why is this even considered a case where somebody is bringing a legitimate monetary claim? As soon as the lender admits, so I lost the collateral, then it should be case closed. Lay malay, haka bilte. The borrower should then be able to say to the lender, oh, you lost my collateral, so then you can collect nothing from me, which is exactly what Shmuel said. And yet the Mishnah obviously is assuming that the lender does still collect the balance. So the Mishnah appears to be against Shmuel. But the Gemara answers, Masnisin b'deparish. In our Mishnah's case, the agreement that the collateral should only be considered a potential payment was articulated. It was, you know, specifically agreed upon that, you know, okay, if the collateral is lost, we deduct that amount from the loan, but not that it would then totally forfeit the lender's ability to collect. Whereas Shmuel b'delo parish, Shmuel is referring to a case where they made no such specific stipulation, and therefore the presumption is that if he's giving him a collateral, the lender is now responsible for that collateral. And the understanding is, if he loses the collateral, even if it was a relatively insignificant value, he simply cannot collect the loan.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD-1. That's 855-275-7231.